Hello, everybody. Good afternoon or good morning, depending on where you happen to be sitting right now, most likely at home. Thanks for joining us. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountRecovery.net, and I'm really excited to be here moderating today's webinar on a guide to how states are regulating debt collection in the time of coronavirus. I normally talk really fast, but I'm going to talk faster than usual today so I can get through this introduction and we can get to our discussion in our esteemed panel as fast as possible. I'm even not even going to say anything about accountsrecovery.net. I'm just going to assume everybody's already checking it out every day. You've signed up for my email newsletters. You're on the webinars. You're everywhere it needs to be. So thank you for that. Let me get into the speaker introductions. First, John Bedard is a nationally recognized authority on the FDCPA and FCRA. He serves as counsel to several professional trade associations, including the Georgia Collectors Association. He's a former member of the board of directors of the industry's leading professional trade organization, ACA International. Stephanie Jackman is the leader of Ballard Spahr's debt collection team and partner, and a partner located in Ballard's Atlanta office. Stephanie is nationally recognized for her expertise in collections, compliance, and litigation across all segments of the financial services industry, including traditional financial products, fintech, and online lending, healthcare, and student lending. Also with us today, Michael Clutho is a shareholder with the Minneapolis law firm of Bassford Remily. A significant part of his practice involves the defense of collection attorneys and collection agencies facing FDCPA, FCRA, and TCPA lawsuits. Michael has defended thousands of consumer lawsuits brought against collection professionals. His practice in this area includes defense of claims brought by governmental regulators overseeing entities involved in the credit and collection industry and risk management audits and advice. Don Maurice is a partner at Maurice Wutcher, representing the financial services industry in compliance matters, trials, and appeals of individual and class actions. Don is a regent of the American College of Consumer Financial Service Lawyers and serves on the governing committee of the Conference on Consumer Finance Law. He formerly chaired the Debt Collection Practices and Bankruptcy Subcommittee of the American Bar Association and serves as outside counsel to Receivables Management Association International, the trade association for debt purchasers. Manny Neuberger leads the Consumer Financial Services Law Practice Group at Barron & Neuberger. He is known nationally for his expertise in consumer and commercial law, defending consumer litigation and regulatory matters across the country, and providing compliance advice and training across the globe. He has taught consumer protection law at the University of Texas School of Law since 1999, and is the author of books and articles covering a variety of consumer financial services laws. The format for today's webinar is going to be a panel discussion with our panel. We're going to go through a series of states. We're going to try to get to as many of the states as we can, which have enacted emergency guidance, emergency regulation, or just simply asked the debt collection really nicely, please and thank you, with a cherry on top, to do what it wants. We're going to try and get to as many of them as we can. If you have a question, you can type it into the Q&A, but hit the Q&A button and type it into the window on the Zoom webinar control panel, and we will try and get to it. And I also want to ask everybody to take a minute and fill out the survey form that should pop up on your screen later. Any ideas, anything you want to learn, any issues you're having? This webinar came about because somebody on Monday said, I don't know what's going on with all the different states. So from Monday to today, we got this together. So if you have a problem, if you have an issue, if you have a question, let me know, and it's going to show up in a webinar. All right, with that, let's move on to our discussion topics. And first, I think we're going to talk about one that's everybody's favorite that's come out in the last couple of days, and that's Wisconsin. And Michael Clutho, we're going to let you start by giving an overview of what's going on in Wisconsin these days.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mike. So Wisconsin has a stay-at-home order that's in place. The issue, though, for Wisconsin is not that you can't collect. You can. Basically, the been deemed to be a licensed collection agency that you folks are able to continue as a licensed financial service provider. So you can still do on-site collections. The issue there is, of course, you know, making sure your employees and that sort of thing are doing social distancing. But what's happened most recently is that the Department of Financial Institutions issued a guidance where they basically said, yeah, you can collect, but, and it was a big but, and they talked about harassment and that kind of business as usual, collections as usual. That will no longer carry the day, at least from their perspective. So there was kind of a big yellow caution light that started flashing, saying, don't be contacting relatives, don't be contacting nearbys. They more or less were indicating that maybe you could make a call, but don't be calling repeatedly. They had a long laundry list of ways that you can be deemed to harass a consumer under these unique circumstances. So the takeaway I got from all that was to really dial things back. Of course, respond to inbounds. If a consumer wants you to contact them, they leave a message, you absolutely can do that. But with respect to outbounds, you should really dial things back and most certainly not be contacting anyone other than the consumer and doing that only sparingly. So that was my takeaway. I don't know, anybody else in the panel saw things differently?
No, Michael, I agree. And I think that, you know, the guidance, I think, reflects also how you need to look at 1692D as well. You know, you take your debtor as you find them. And in some instances, you're going to find debtors that are in extraordinary distress. I thought it odd coming from Wisconsin, though, and the way I read it is like a global pandemic. And because of these global conditions, it creates an event here in Wisconsin. I mean, I think it can change from place to place, and even within county to county in some places. For example, here in my home state in New Jersey, the closer you get to New York City, the more cases you have. But as you go farther and farther away, you find there are less. So the more distress you have would be the closer you are to where there are those types of extraordinary limitations. But still, I think it's a good idea to heed what the regulator is saying, because I think it has wider application than just to Wisconsin.
One of the things that I found interesting, Michael, I know you practice in Wisconsin federal courts, as do I. The Wisconsin federal courts are much more relaxed about what's going on than a lot of courts around the country. You go over to Chicago and they've extended every deadline there is for 45 days and canceled all settings through, I think, the end of May. Wisconsin courts have not really shut things down in the same way a lot of other places have. So on the one hand, you got the federal courts that seem to be operating with some measure of effectiveness. And then you've got the state regulator saying, basically, don't do anything. Are you seeing the same thing, Michael?
Yeah, no, it's an odd, and Stephanie, we were talking about that earlier. It's a hodgepodge of what we're facing, and it's really difficult to boil this down to give, you know, succinct advice for each individual state. Not only that, it changes. It's changing almost daily with some of these states as of their guidance.
So, yeah.
I think, Don, you go ahead, Stephanie.
I was just going to add, we were talking ahead of time about that. And one of the things that, particularly as part of preparing for this webinar and just looking back through everything that's been out there, it feels like regulators are saying a lot because they are. But when you look back, a lot of it's through this lens of its guidance or best practices. And what does that mean? And I feel like they're trading on fear. The fear that you have as a licensee of them coming back at you and judging you retroactively. And it's just got me kind of thinking, well, that's going to happen anyway. And some of the things that they're saying you should do or they think is a best practice or best help consumers, well, that's all well and good, except a number of my clients, I'm sure you gentlemen are hearing the same thing, they won't be able to keep the lights on. So then they have a whole population of consumers who they haven't already had to furlough or lay off because of the adjustments they've already had to make within their operations, who are going to be harmed. So we have to have some balancing. And I'm wondering if part of the reason for this guidance and this best practice, instead of actual announcements and leadership from a regulator on expectations, is because they don't know if it would be enforceable. I suspect in some instances it wouldn't be. And I know some of you have thoughts on that. And that's what brings me back to it's more trading on fear. And when I'm talking with clients about how to comply across all of these states, you know, there's the best practice of trying to do all you can, but I'm not treating a lot of these, and my sense is people that are out there also are not as requirements unless they say they are.
You know, Michael, my biggest takeaway from Wisconsin, despite how, you know, sort of firm this language is in this this note here, is that it's important for collectors to be identifying consumers that have been affected by the pandemic in some way, either by unemployment or underemployment or symptoms or they're caring for children, whatever it is. It's important for collectors to be identifying consumers who've been affected in some way by the pandemic and then to treat those consumers differently, to have a different, it's not, you know, the takeaway here is it's not business as usual for those consumers. And the government's expectation there in Wisconsin is that collectors will be identifying those consumers and will be treating them differently because of the impact that this pandemic has had on them. That's really my biggest takeaway from Wisconsin.
And to that extent, John, I've been trying to get collectors to ask more questions. And it seems to me, starting with things like, how are you doing? And being sure you ask if people are currently employed become critical questions, because documenting whether someone is employed may help you answer questions down the road when someone says, well, why were you talking to this person? Well, he was employed. I asked him if his wages had been impacted. He said, no, actually, he's working more than he did before. This is the kind of stuff we need to know. If someone's out of work and subject to a stay-at-home order, and you call them on Monday and they tell you that, and you know the stay-at-home orders are still in effect, what do you think is going to be different on Friday? On the other hand, if someone's fully employed or working extra, I'm not sure why the state has a legitimate interest in saying you shouldn't be calling them.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Manny and John. I think it's a lot of asking open-ended questions and then listening, getting the response, and then scaling your response to what the person says. And if, you know, those recordings are listened to, you know, 6 months from now by our regulator, you're going to be comfortable with them.
You know, that's not different than what agencies teach collectors today. It's not any different. We listen to the consumer. We understand their circumstance. When hardship, you know, circumstances arise, they deal with that. It seems to me that despite the language here in this guidance, it's not a lot different than what we know professional debt collectors are doing every day, not just during this pandemic, but always.
Yeah, spot on, John. And there are the bad apples that'll make a bad name for our industry, but by and large, folks are doing what you just said, and they need to continue to do it. Be empathetic as they can.
Before we move on to our next state, we've got a question that's come in, so I'll use this as an opportunity to ask it and also to remind everybody, if you have a question for our panel, type it into the Q&A box on your Zoom webinar control panel, and we'll get to it in the next 45 minutes or so. The question that came in is, would you say we should be initiating those conversations with consumers that call in to us as well as our outbound calls? We don't want to give consumers an excuse not to pay. Does anyone want to take that?
Well, so if I may, I'll jump in, because I know that one of the states I was going to cover is North Carolina, so it gives me a chance to do that. Sorry, I just realized I was leaning in towards the camera. I'll try to sit up and not act like one of the people in the skit from Saturday Night Live this weekend. In North Carolina, there was an FAQ that came out from the Commissioner of Insurance, which regulates, among other entities, licensed collection agencies in North Carolina, and in its FAQs, to clarify guidance in a bulletin that came out earlier in March on the 27th, they said that if you can engage in outbound collection efforts, that's fine. They're not restricting you from sending letters and making communications. But when you do so, they imposed an affirmative obligation on you to advise the consumer that you are offering deferrals. Just like if a consumer calls in and says they're impacted, you have to offer payment deferrals. And there's detail around that. However, save for North Carolina and maybe one or two other states that are just not coming to my mind right now, that's generally not what we're seeing. And I'm not inclined to advise a proactive reach out. But to the earlier points, I can't remember if it was John or Manny or who was saying it, but trying to explore with consumers who answer and talk to you why they're unable to make payment, what they can and tease out if they're impacted by COVID makes sense. But I don't think you jump out in front of it, because everybody's impacted by COVID in some way, shape, or form at this point, and it will increase the number of people who identify as impacted, and that could actually reduce your ability to accommodate people even more who are truly impacted. So absent a requirement, no, I don't proactively advertise it in the collection space. I would advise differently when you're in the creditor space, but that's a different webinar topic and audience.
Okay, excellent. Moving on, let's stay in the Midwest and spend a few minutes talking about Minnesota. Michael, I know that's your home state, so we'll let you take lead on that one as well.
Yeah, I appreciate that. When I talk about Minnesota, I want to talk about the time that we call BC. That's before coronavirus. It's a new term now. John, what do you think? Work with that. So BC, we had been working with the Minnesota Department of Commerce, the regulator, to actually do some amending of the statute that governs debt collectors. And one of the things we were working on with them and having dialogue and meetings was about work from home, because Minnesota prohibits work from home for collection agencies. What's interesting is that we had no idea that coronavirus was going to be upon us in a matter of a month or two after we were meeting with them. And lo and behold, our governor shut down the state. We did a stay at home, designated essential services, and ultimately issued an express determination that collection agencies are not essential services, NOT. So then it got difficult. It was essentially shutting down agencies unless they could work from home. Well, we went back to the Department of Commerce and worked with them, and they issued a no action, if you will, decision. I think it was based on Maine, similar sort of decision there that said you can work from home even though it's a prohibited practice, but we aren't going to take any action from you unless you do something else wrong, harass consumers or those sorts of things. So that was very helpful to have had that kind of prior discussion, so that it led real nicely into them issuing that guidance. That then allows agencies, collectors, to work from home through April 30th. Well, that sounds fine. That was actually longer than the stay-at-home, original stay-at-home order. The rub of it is that our governor has now issued a new stay-at-home order through midnight on May 3rd. And the work from home order or guidance says we can do it through April 30th. So there are 3 days that don't really work. There are Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. At the end of the period, we're asking the department to give some further guidance and hopefully allow that to happen during that time period as well. Stay tuned on that. But that's the backdrop on what's going on in Minnesota. The other part of it is we've been trying to get some guidance from the governor, Deed, the Department of Economic and Employment Development, something like that, as to can you go on site? If your business is shut down, can you show up? And there's been now some guidance that's come out that says essential functions. You can show up on site to check your IT, to go in and maybe process payroll. They've gone through a list of items that you can show up on site for, but you're not going to be able to do any collections there. So it's not a full back office type of thing, but it is to make sure your business is secure, everything's working properly. You can show up from time to time to do that. So that's essentially what's going on in Minnesota. You can collect from home, but not on site. And like Wisconsin, be nice.
Michael, you mentioned the essential functions, but you know the CISA, the Cybersecurity Infrastructure and Security Agency, says that the financial sector is one of the essential infrastructure business sectors, and we've got agencies and law firms receiving payments for financial institutions. And for a variety of security reasons, those payments need to be opened in the office, in the room with the cameras. And they've got to be deposited. Even worse, you've got state laws all over the country, I think including Minnesota, that make you financially accountable for depositing and remitting and reporting on those payments that you receive. And the thing I'm not seeing is any of the states willing to come forward and say, oh yeah, we're telling you don't come into your office, but we're not suspending or waiving your absolute non-negotiable duty to deposit, remit, and report.
I don't disagree with you, Manny. It's they're not looking at the level of granularity that you're referencing, and frankly, that's kind of a big issue, isn't it? Payment processing. Personally, I would think that, because I've specifically raised that issue with the Department of Commerce folks, that payment processing in a secure environment, that is very, very important. And how could I say it? They indicated the words that were reflected back to me was that they expect good faith compliance with the rules and the guidances. And so my gut takeaway from that was if you are required to do secure payment processing in a one person in a room type of thing with cameras, I'm not so sure that they're going to do any enforcement as to that.
Well, of course, you've got one of the more rational regulators in the country there. They actually really try to work with industry when they can to let industry function within a regulated environment.
Rational regulator. I like that, Manny.
All right. Is there anything else on Minnesota that we need to discuss before we move on? No? Okay. Manny, we're going to talk about another state that's been really active in terms of guidance, and that's Massachusetts. Why don't you lead us through what they've done?
Sure. So Attorney General Maura Healey filed emergency regulations on, I believe, March 26th with the Massachusetts Secretary of State. The general is empowered to issue regulations affecting debt collection. In this case, she's issued emergency regulations, which she has the power to issue for a limited period of time. These regulations suspend a variety of collection practices, including judgment enforcement, repossession, filing suits, confronting people in person. Importantly for the industry, initiating outbound calls to consumers, except in response to a request. So, if a consumer calls you and leaves a message, you can call them back. If they ask you to call back, you can do it. But otherwise, you cannot initiate outbound calls to them if you are a debt collector. And debt collector for this purpose means a collection agency, a law firm, or a debt buyer. Creditors themselves are still permitted to initiate outbound calls to their customers. These regulations have a limited time frame, and frankly, if the general's going to try to extend them, she's pretty soon going to have to take action to go through a more formalized process. Otherwise, they're going to expire after 90 days or 30 days after the end of the emergency period, whichever comes first. The Attorney General's office has issued guidance. Much of the guidance is, I think, redundant of the emergency regulations, but an attempt to respond carefully and thoughtfully to questions they've been getting. A few things that are, I think, important. They've acknowledged that written communications are permitted. If you're going to text your customers, you should keep in mind that Massachusetts has already existing guidance on texts and text frequency that you're going to have to comply with. If you are sending letters or emails, though, that is not forbidden if you are a debt collector. If you have to go to court, the prohibition on in-person confrontation or speaking to someone in person is not applicable to appearances at the courthouse. Similarly, they seem to be willing to permit outbound communications as necessary to let people know of court settings. Generally, there's a rationality that's wrapped around it. They now are designating CARES Act payments as public assistance and putting it within the scope of assets that can't be attached or garnished. All this is fine. My concerns, though, are kind of fundamental. And to me, Massachusetts is important because when I look at what some of the states are doing, it sure looks like a number of the states are modeling their provisions on Massachusetts or using that as a starting point. I can't get past the fact that in prohibiting calls concerning debt collection, places like Massachusetts are engaging in a content-specific prior restraint on speech. And some of you have heard my complaints about this already. I think there's a First Amendment problem. there's a separate First Amendment problem saying you can't file suits, which is the petition clause of the First Amendment. But the response the AG gives to that, I think, is that the Massachusetts statute of limitations has been at least temporarily extended. So they're saying you're not really being denied access to courts, you're merely being delayed access to courts. But the restriction on calls is very troubling to me. I just can't get past that. Apart from that, I have a serious concern from a compliance and operations perspective. In any place that is following the Massachusetts model where you are permitted to communicate in writing on an outbound basis, I think there's likely to be a serious internal push at a collection business to push more outbound written communications, hoping you'll drive more inbound calls. And I think not just an increase in the number of letters, but also in the variety of letters. And unfortunately, when you have a lot of pressure to start sending out new letters, the question is going to be, are they going to go through the same level of review and the same thoughtful, careful process that normally would be undertaken when reviewing and approving letters? I think this is a time where there's a lot of risk. If you're going to start pushing out a lot more written communications, you'd better spend time with your compliance officers or your compliance counsel, letting them look at the letters you're proposing to send and being certain that in this drive to get people to call you, you're not crossing the line. Because, for example, threatening someone with suit in Massachusetts would violate the emergency regulations. Could your letter be construed as a threat of suit? Well, there are a lot of things that we may not think are threats of suit, but the case law says could be construed that way. And so I would strongly encourage having your compliance officers look very carefully at everything. And I wouldn't just say, you got an hour and we're sending it out. I think you've got to give people adequate time. Stephanie, John, I know you guys do a lot of compliance work. Do you share that concern at all?
No doubt, Manny. And the pressure to expedite the production of letters is very high under these circumstances. And the likelihood of error is also very high if those letters aren't given proper scrutiny. Absolutely. I share, Manny, your constitutional concerns here. I get incensed when I see some of these absolute prohibitions on communications, not just the kind that we see in Massachusetts, but we're going to talk about DC. We're going to talk about some others. I think that during times of crisis, we, all of us, regulators, attorneys, clients, collectors, we need to focus on the need to adhere even more strictly to those fundamental freedoms and principles that we all have, more so than when things are not in crisis, because the risk of violating those principles, I think, is even higher during crisis times. And there is no better evidence of that conclusion than what we're seeing in Massachusetts, what we're seeing in Washington, D.C., what we're seeing around the country, which is well-intentioned, well-intentioned policymakers and lawmakers ignoring the fundamental principles that our justice system is based on. And it begins with the constitutional issues that you just mentioned.
Yeah, it always bothers me when people in government tell me that they just want what's best for the public, which is to take away fundamental constitutional rights.
And
we're certainly seeing that here. I mean, you know, we're getting close to the point on some of these provisions that we're going to talk about to the question of whether they constitute a taking of property without compensation, which is a separate issue under the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. And through all of these, by the way, you have separate questions of which of the provisions have been held to apply to the states under the 14th Amendment, but the ones we're talking about do. Okay, we know the Fifth Amendment applies to the states. We know the First Amendment applies to the states through the 14th Amendment. And as well-intentioned as these are, and I have to say, Massachusetts to me is a really good example. You have a consumer protection division that I think has some very bright, principled, honorable people there. I say that because I'm licensed there and I deal with that office regularly. They don't hate the collection industry. I think they're trying to do in Massachusetts what they believe is truly right. And unfortunately, in trying to do what they think is the right thing, they're walking all over the Constitution.
And the thing that I get most upset about is the complacency with which we all that are watching this sort of approach it with. It's not okay. It really is not okay for that to be happening. But the fact that there isn't this enormous pushback on this kind of behavior, government behavior that ignores these kind of principles, is the thing that I worry about the most. Because if we become complacent over these things now in times of crisis, then in the future, we're going to just accept that it's okay. And it's not okay to accept that now. It's not okay to accept that in the future. And history is no better teacher of those principles than what we should be doing right now to resist this kind of ignorance of those principles.
Well, we're not done in Massachusetts because I think this is going to be shifting from the AG to the legislature. Over a week ago, the chair of the House Financial Services Committee there, James Murphy, introduced a bill that is proposing to take many of the restrictions you already see from the AG and extend them for a further period. And that period, I believe, would extend even 60 days after the emergency is declared to have been ended. So while the AG did get out the first shot, the legislature, which has not gone out of session and is not about to pause, is going ahead. And I will tell you that I know that since the time that I have been representing the RMAI, we have been in Massachusetts multiple times a year. I was there just in January meeting with Chair Murphy and consumer advocates. And I know that also representatives of the New England Creditors Bar and the New England Debt Collectors were also there at these meetings. And Massachusetts is not a favorable state for the arms and ARM industry. They have the center of many consumer advocacy groups, like the NCLC are there. Greater Boston Legal Services is ferocious when it comes to advocacy on behalf of consumers and takes very extraordinary, extreme measures. They have had a bill, I refer to it as the Massachusetts Get a Free House Bill, that RMA has been fighting for nearly half a decade. And that is still there. That is still rolling through the process. And that bill has extraordinary relief, like expunging debt. So I'm not surprised at all to have seen what we saw out of the AG's office. And I wouldn't be surprised that in the next 2 or 3 weeks, we see the legislature pass a measure which would make this even a more viable restriction for debt collectors in Massachusetts. And I think, Manny, you mentioned that about the CARES Act exemption, and it serves to let everyone know that the Massachusetts AG issued her opinion earlier this week. It may have been last Friday or Monday, saying that she believes that any stimulus received from the federal government would be exempt in Massachusetts under the public assistance. And we saw also the Ohio AG just issued a very similar letter. RMAI, in guidance to its members, has, before even these letters came out, have suggested that its members treat these stimulus payments that way. When I first started talking to consumer advocates in mid-March, I was meeting with a group in New York City. That was one of the first things that they were concerned about, was if there was going to be federal stimulus, because I think at that time there was just talk of it, that they would be hands-off. And each group that we've talked to, each regulatory group, whether it's federal, state, or even local, have all repeated that. So that may be something that you think about as far as how you're going to address those stimulus funds.
Well, frankly, if you're a law firm, you may want to proactively put out word to the banks saying we're directing you not to hold any funds traceable to a stimulus payment. Because the court order may not address it, but I think to show that you're trying not to freeze them giving an affirmative directive would certainly be an additional bit of protection. Don, what concerns me about what you just said is that the legislature doing something changes the game, because the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, in a footnote in a decision in the last couple of years, was critical of the Attorney General's debt collection regulations, suggested that they were vague and that the general should clarify them if she wanted them followed.
I think that's where this is going, Manny, and I think that's why the legislature is taking it up. You know, and many of our discussions of legislation, and again, I'm referring to the Get a Free House bill, staff from the Attorney General's office participate in those. They're very much behind that movement as well. So it's there's a reason why they refer to it as the People's Republic of Massachusetts. Let me just put it that way. And it is on display for all of you. Just spend a little time there on Beacon Hill.
Well said. And on that note, we'll move from Massachusetts back to the Midwest, and we'll spend some time in the great state of Illinois, which has also been very active in issuing guidance and the governor sending executive orders about what collectors can and can't do. So Stephanie, why don't you walk us through what's been going on in Illinois?
Sure, I'll hit the highlights and also try to, looking at some of the questions that have come in, maybe bring up a few topics for the panel to also give thoughts on, because it's not just limited to Illinois. So first of all, Illinois banned repossessions. They're not alone in that. The Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulation, IDFPR, which are always at the top of my list of regulators that are aggressive in this space, along with Massachusetts and others. They have said that collection agencies are not essential services under the governor's shelter-in-place order, and asked, are authorizing remote work, as many of you probably already know, but wanted notice of address changes. And then they put out some guidance on April 3rd saying, well, you can do that by sending an email that says the name of the employees and the location they're working from. So that's, and they're not the only state that's done that. And that has understandably caused some concern about disclosing home addresses of collection agent employees. You know, I would ask the rest of the panel what they're seeing, because I agree, and my understanding has been that regulators have been willing to hear those concerns and work through that, but I don't know if that's specific to Illinois, to be candid. So that's one thing. I don't know if anybody has any thoughts on before I hit the other highlights of Illinois, but protecting your agent's privacy.
It's a big concern that I have, because a lot of these licensing schemes have in them the ability of the commissioner to visit the site where the collections are being undertaken. And if you're doing it remotely, I'm sure they could interpret it that way. But whether they will is yet to be seen. I mean, this is the first global pandemic I've lived through. Hopefully I live through. And so we will see what happens in the end. But I have to believe that there is going to be at least some consideration of the extraordinary circumstances. But you're right, Stephanie, and it's a concern. It's not only the privacy, but they can actually, in some instances, go to their house and look at the records that are maintained there. So,
Stephanie, I do have an email from the department confirming that home addresses would be treated as non-public information. And quite honestly, they were extremely fast at responding to that inquiry.
I would expect that would be the case, because there's a whole host of issues there. And to your point, Don, you know, hopefully the agencies in saying that, including Illinois, in allowing remote work, you're still subject to all the laws. And Illinois went on to list some of those laws in case we had forgotten them, FDCPA, FCRA, SCRA, privacy laws, and that they're going to hold you accountable for monitoring that. So while that certainly has a negative side, at least to your point, hopefully that does reveal itself to mean they're not going to be paying home visits, and they'll depend on the agencies themselves to be responsible for that. But you're right. I mean, we don't know, and the authority is certainly there. Illinois FPR, IDFPR, I always struggle with that acronym because it's very long, also has put out a list of best practices. that are talking about how they would like you as a collector that has a license issued by them to approach things. And I'm seeing a lot of questions, and we earlier talked about, I think it was you, Manny, trying to identify impacted consumers and being nice and trying to give them assistance and sending the, and conveying that message, but also tempering it with, are we going to proactively reach out and the impacts that can have. Illinois is not requiring any of this, but they are encouraging. And I put that in air quotes because that's the actual word that they use. Encouraging you to work with consumers to modify payment schedules, suspend or suspend collections for 60 days. They're not requiring you to do so, but they're putting out statements that say, so if any of these other things we want you to do, monitor compliance with law, ensure privacy and accuracy and what you're doing, et cetera, doesn't work out, well, you could have just stopped. That's not practical, but it is out there, and that's how I would expect it to come back. So then they've gone on. Well, they want you to increase communication with your consumers. Okay. They want you to ensure you have sufficient staffing to manage the inbound calls, emails, whatever the different channels you make available are. And by the way, they want you to encourage to try to expand those channels to consumers at the same time that you may be in a situation like a lot of clients of having to reduce staff, having to figure out how to get everyone what they need to work remotely. And there's huge challenges there, but they're just encouraging you to do that. They want you, when you connect with these consumers in whatever way you do, to be proactive in reaching out to offer payment options, deferrals, things like that. They have talked about offering to proactively reach out to people on payment plans or things that are non-contractual things the consumer has just agreed to do, like pre-authorized ACHs, a payment plan, or just they may not have an official agreement with you, but they just have it set up that every month $50 comes in, and talk about their options. And it gets challenging, right? Because none of these are required. So what I think about in a state like Illinois is I try to take its temperature. And it's clear that they want you, when you do connect with a consumer, however that is, to work with them and try to assess their situation. So I do, to Manny's earlier point, think it's important to identify if they are COVID impacted and then talk about what you can do to work with them and be nice. Do I think you need to go out and proactively ask people that are on payment plans or pre-authorized withdrawals or somewhere in the process, hey, are you impacted and can we help you? I just can't get there because I just don't think it's operation. I don't think a lot of companies would survive that. So that's sort of where I'm drawing the line, unless you are required to apprise them of such things in an outbound communication like North Carolina, but we're talking about Illinois. But here's an added benefit of trying to get that information when you connect. Illinois is encouraging you to avoid negative reporting. We had some questions about this. Using CDIA's disaster codes. And don't forget, the CARES Act has put some requirements in place on how you should be reporting accounts. There's for accounts that are current and get a deferral. And there also are accounts that are already delinquent but get some sort of accommodation. And we could have a whole nother webinar about CARES Act and what it is. But in a general sense, I'm telling people, take a broad view of what an accommodation is. It has to be reasonable, but a broad view. There's some examples in the CARES Act, but I don't see that to be an exclusive list. So if, for instance, you have suspended all repossessions across the entire country on accounts where they would otherwise be in repo, I would say call that an accommodation. And it's helping avoid potential FCRA issues because then you'll put that flag or that code on the account. The bureaus will treat it however they treat it, but it's protecting you from a claim or an allegation that you somehow were inaccurate or unfair in reporting it the way you did, et cetera. But I saw a question about this, and yes, some states are saying avoid negative furnishing. It's always just an urging. And remember, the FCRA preempts state law, so the CARES Act is what you really need to comply with. But in responding to somebody in the QA, if you can avoid beginning to furnish negative information, perhaps consider doing that right now. If you are, and just to be clear though, if you are already furnishing on an account, you need to continue to do so accurately under the FCRA, and you're not going to be forgiven for doing that unless you delete. So if you're already furnishing and an account goes into a delinquent status or a new status, that's where using things like the disaster codes and understanding that somebody is impacted by COVID or needs an accommodation can actually help protect you. Anybody else have some thoughts?
There's a lot there. I consider Illinois to be a hot state. I've actually mapped these. I'll share that a bit later. But there are several states right now. I'm looking at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 states that I would consider hot, and that is one of them. I think that it's that way, Stephanie. Not only for the reasons that you say, the guidance being so amorphous, but the fact that it has also a very active plaintiffs bar there, and I think that they will use these very amorphous guidelines to bring actions later on. So any type of activity that you're engaged in a state like Illinois that has issued this type of guidance, you should be very concerned about. Pay attention again to the consumers' responses, the circumstances that they're in as well when collecting from them there.
The only other fun thing to say about Illinois, and I completely agree with you, Don, Illinois is one of the hottest states out there and has said something on pretty much everything. Mm-hmm. So to that point, they've also said no more garnishment. Mm-hmm. They don't want garnishment to start. They don't want it to continue. And the only exemption is for domestic support obligations like child support and spousal support. And I read that because they're not the only state doing it. Massachusetts has done it. Ohio has done it. And I think Washington just had something come out that Manny, I think you shared with us. I read those to be in response to the fact that the stimulus payments under the CARES Act started rolling out on Monday. 25 state AGs and 23 senators have sent letters saying we need to close what is perceived to be a loophole to garnish those in certain instances. So some states are taking that position that in under state law, those are exempt public assistance payments, et cetera, and Illinois is one of them.
And it's, you know, you're right, Stephanie, it's beyond just suspension of garnishment and wage deductions. You also can't take, you can't discover the assets as well. So you're pretty much shut down on post-judgment activity in Illinois.
John, Stephanie brought up Washington State. That's something that's just starting. It looks like they're just starting to get involved and get more active. Maybe you can walk us through what they've done so far and what you expect they may do in the future.
Thank you, Mike. Mike, this is hot off the presses. In fact, it's still warm, this order that I just received, because they just issued it yesterday on the 14th. And it's just a few pages long. But the import here of this order is that the state of Washington, they've done some gymnastics here. They've completely suspended the statutes that talk about garnishment. And so they are completely suspended in total throughout the state. But then what the governor does is goes backwards and says, well, wait a minute, we're gonna make an exception. The suspension does not apply to everybody except to the garnishment of wages and other income to collect judgments for consumer debt. And so there's a complete ban on garnishment, a complete suspension on all of those garnishment procedures. And then they go on to make an exception for everybody except for judgment creditors who are garnishing wages and other income to collect judgments. Now, what I've just done is read to you the ordering clause of this order. It's the garnishment of wages and other income, right? Now, it does not define what other income means in the ordering clause. However, if we look at different sections of the order, that term has implied meaning. So for example, we talked about stimulus funds. Although the ordering clause does not prohibit directly and expressly the garnishment of stimulus money, it does refer to stimulus money up in the whereas clauses. We've seen a lot of these orders that say, whereas the world has been affected, whereas the sky is falling, whereas all these things. Well, one of those whereas clauses is, whereas we think, you know, garnishment of wages and stimulus funds would jeopardize consumers' ability to, you know, pay for necessities and things like that. And so although the ordering clause does not reference stimulus money at all, other places in the order do. There are also other places in the order in the whereas clauses, which talk about garnishments that reduced the ability of people impacted by the economic downturn to pay for basic household expenses, therefore increasing life, health, and safety risks as a result of the COVID pandemic, right? Doesn't say anything about that in the ordering clause, but it does suggest, and it probably is a fair reading of the order, that any garnishment that would affect the ability of people impacted to provide for their basic household expenses on and on is a garnishment that this order is intended to prohibit, notwithstanding that the ordering clause does not use that language. And so we have a roundabout way of banning something and then accepting certain things from the ban. And then we have intimation about what the order might mean when it says wages and other income, even though it doesn't use those very terms in the order. So what does that mean? What's the long and short of all this in Washington? Well, it's very express and clear that wage garnishments for the moment here, or at least until May 14th is when this order is set to expire. Until May 14th, it is clear that wage garnishments are prohibited in Washington. It is also clear that garnishments on, quote, other income are also prohibited, although the order doesn't actually define what, quote, other income actually is. To the extent we can read this order in totality, and we can read other income to mean something that might affect a consumer's ability to provide for their basic household expenses, potentially, it is a reading, and it may be a fair reading of the order to make that conclusion. I think it's just as fair to conclude that what the order does not say is just as important as what it does say, and that wages and other income are akin to income akin to wages, not necessarily income in any other form that it might come in. And so that's a whole mouthful to describe what Washington just did yesterday, but nonetheless, it's focused on garnishments only. It's focused on wage garnishments and garnishments of other income, whatever that may be.
And it makes it a criminal penalty to do so.
Correct. That's right. Violators of this chapter may be subject to criminal penalties, pursuant to, and then it goes on to talk about the criminal statute section there, which is, again, why I think it's important. Defendants subject to criminal penalties for violating this order, I think they're going to get a much more fair reading of what it actually prohibits than what we all think it might impliedly it prohibit.
You know, the thing though, that if there's one thing that we could take from this and say, okay, well, that's not so bad. Like we just pointed out in Massachusetts, it was going to extend that, at least was going to extend for 60 days following the emergency being undone. And New Jersey's proposed bill, it was even longer. This is only a month. It's still possible they could extend it. I'd hate to see what the legislature would do. This is not a favorable state for the industry at all. I would not want to see what this legislature would do, but it is for a month. But otherwise, John, you know, I think you hit it right in the head here. So,
John, need to point out, Washington's not the only one to impose criminal penalties. And right. I've got to return to the discussion we were having earlier. What do you think about the executive branch deciding that it's suspending court orders issued by the judicial branch?
Thank you. There's a real power, I don't want to say a struggle, but a power grab here. We have courts abolishing statute of limitations. We have executives that are making decisions about judicial orders. And so there's this big, but Manny, you know that all of these orders are very well-intentioned, and it's to protect the very people that have elected them there. And so certainly these can't be bad things that these people are doing, which is issuing these orders and exercising all this authority. You're not suggesting that, are you?
John, yeah, here's the problem. A lot of these orders are doing the very things I'd tell my clients to do. Don't go out and take people's wages while they're working on reduced wages, or while one of the spouses is out of work. conceptually, the things they want the industry to do are things that probably all of us would tell our clients.
Right.
But yeah, I've got real problems when they step on the Constitution and doing it. Good intentions all lead to one end place. We know where it is. And in fact, one of the things that intrigued me, because I was looking at some of the constitutional cases just last week, you know, the Supreme Court of the United States says that even the war powers can't be used to suppress fundamental liberties granted by the Constitution. So yeah, it's a state of emergency, and people should act like human beings, and they should treat other people decently. And I'll quote our adversary Pete Berry and say, with truthfulness, dignity, courtesy, and respect. But the government shouldn't be treading all over constitutional rights, and they ought to be able to figure out what the powers are of the various branches and not be stealing the powers of one another.
Amen.
This is still supposed to be a democracy, and if a pandemic destroys the fundamental functions of our country and of our republic, that's a whole other problem.
John, first of all, I want to say you stuck the landing on the gymnastics metaphor. Well done. And then we're talking about democracy. So let's move to the seat of democracy, Washington, D.C. And I'm going to bring in Don Maurice to talk about, even though it's not a state, it certainly has done a lot to govern debt collection and definitely warrants some discussion today. So Don, why don't you take us through it?
So the D.C. Council acts like its legislature, although it's a unicameral, one body, and they did pass on April 7 an emergency order that would apply to debt collectors and debt buyers, and it prohibits outbound communications to consumers regarding debts. And you should look at what debts is defined as there. Using any form of written or electronic communication, including letters, emails, texts, or phone calls, but you are not deemed to have initiated a communication with a debtor if it is in response to a request made to you by the debtor. And creditors and debt collectors alike are prohibited from pursuing legal remedies such as lawsuits, civil actions, repossession activities. And it does have a limited period of time. I believe that this is going to go through at least till maybe July. I may be wrong on that. Have to pull up the actual text of it to see. But I would, in response to this, I would carefully look at what they define a debt as in Washington, D.C. But then again, I think the D.C. Council very much intends this to apply to all debts, although they may not realize that the text of their statute doesn't do that. The Attorney General in D.C. has already issued, of course, I'm talking about the District of Columbia's Attorney General, has already issued a press release saying he's going to enforce it. So I think that back to what Stephanie says, hot places, D.C. is on my hot places that you have to be very careful in.
Excellent. Thank you. You know, one of the first states that took action back when all of this started and seems so long ago now was Nevada.
Yes.
Maybe you can walk us through, Don, what Nevada's done and sort of maybe talk about some of the ramifications of what's happened in the state since then.
Well, what Nevada has done is said that a licensed collection agency simply cannot communicate at all with debtors. They had said here that it's deemed non-essential, and as a result, they are to close if you're within the state, and you must cease collection efforts with Nevada consumers. And this goes back now to March 20. And March 20 is a special day, Mr. Gibb, for you and I, because that's when life began to change in New Jersey as well. And it changed for debt collectors in Nevada. Subsequent to that, RMAI wrote to the Nevada Department of Business and Industry Financial Institutions because this presented a problem. It presented a problem because when you say stop all communication, well, what if you're getting payments? What if you're getting inquiries and things of that sort? But we had two things that we posed to them were payments. The payments were a real problem. What do we do? We're receiving payments from consumers who have established payment plans, and maybe we're getting voluntary payments where they don't have payment plans. So the deputy commissioner wrote to us and said, and I'll quote, collection agencies should be mindful of the hardship this causes, et cetera. If a consumer initiates the communication payment and they want to pay and have the ability to do so, you may accept the payment. A consumer should have the choice to proceed with their prearranged payments or to pause collections. No fees should be charged on later missed payments. So at least that allowed us some breathing room on the issue of accepting payments, because that would have also been prohibited by a strict reading of the rule. So there you have it, Mike, in Nevada. Unfortunately, there's plenty of other states that have issued guidance, and there's other restrictions. I saw some of the questions there. We could spend, I think we're done at 2:00, right?
We're supposed to be, but
there's plenty of other issues that we need to address in these other states. I don't even think, Stephanie, we did North Carolina yet. Which is, to me, one of the most extraordinary restrictions I've ever seen, because they took an insurance, a typical insurance disaster type of order, and they applied it to debt collection. And the only thing I could tell you in our limited time here is, on North Carolina, read that statute carefully. Go beyond the order and look at the statute and the type of contracts that it's talking about and what that deferral period is for those contracts. I think there's a lot of confusion around that. And there's a lot of confusion, as we all pointed out, among all of these pieces of guidance, these regulations and these statutes. And why is that? Well, it's because the usual process is gone. You know, when we deal with a regulation, and you all see it now, with in the federal level, we have a notice of a proposed regulation, and we have the ability to comment, to explain what the problems are, operational and legal, that we may be facing. The same thing with legislation. We offer testimony, both written and verbal. We have lobbyists. I mean, and Massachusetts alone, I think the industry has 4 lobbyists working on one bill. We don't have lobbyists. We could use them, but where do you meet with a legislator? In New Jersey, for example, you all are familiar with New Jersey proposed legislation. That was put on the agenda a week ago. Not even a week ago. It was Thursday before Easter for a vote on Monday. And New Jersey is closed on Holy Thursday, Good Friday, right? And we're supposed to have a vote on Monday. By the way, it was tabled. They didn't pass it. But there's no opportunity for us to speak with legislators anymore, except on rare occasions. And how is the legislator meeting? They're meeting the same way we're meeting here. So all of those different checks that we have are gone. And that means that also we're dealing with confusion. We're dealing with statutes and regulations that, as many of you have pointed out, are well-intended, but they have horrible mistakes. The only thing I could tell everyone is proceed with caution in any of these states that have issued guidance or regulations or other restrictions.
Well, and Don, to your point about North Carolina, you know, it's interesting contrasting North Carolina with D.C. D.C. has, and we had a question about this, D.C. has actually said no outbound collections of any type. Forget limiting it to calls. You don't get to do any. North Carolina is quite artful in what it did, because it didn't actually say you can't do that. But what it did say is that if you do any outbound efforts of any type through any channel, you have to advise that you are obligated, upon the consumer telling you that they have a COVID-19 impact, to cease collection activity against them for, it started out, I think, at 60 days, but it's been reduced to 30. So basically through, I think right now that guidance when it was issued and the FAQs, that's through April 29th. But it essentially, you know, the question was, are there any states that have wholesale shut down collections? I said, well, D.C., but North Carolina has without actually doing it, to your point about it being one of the more significant jurisdictions. Because if I call, you know, Don, you haven't paid me, all right? I don't think you actually have any outstanding bills, but I call you and you answer. I have to say, you know, Hi, Mr. Maurice. This is Stephanie Jackman with XYC Agency. I'm a collector. I give you the mini Miranda. And by the way, you owe me a debt, but I have to accommodate you. I have to give you a 30-day payment deferral. Do you need that? What do you think their answer is going to be?
You know, Stephanie, I agree. I think the problem is with North Carolina is, and you raised this before, the debt collectors in North Carolina are regulated by the Commissioner of Insurance, not banking, not financial services, insurance. What they put out is a typical order for deferral of insurance premiums during a disaster. This is done in other states, and other states have done it in response to the COVID epidemic. The problem is they just shoved debt collection in here. And again, if you look at the statute behind the order, and there's a statute that says what you have to do, it says the deferral period shall be 30 days from the last day the premium or debt payment may be made under the terms of the policy or contract. Now, when you're dealing with charged off debt, that period ended maybe 2 or 3 years ago. So what, you had 30 days from 3 years ago? That's why I'm saying I don't, you know, but that is that, that's how it would read, right? Except what the commissioner put out is a press release saying, well, this affords everyone relief from debt collection. So what they intend and what is happening in the statute appear to be two different things. And again, what can I say? Proceed with caution. Should you, I'm not gonna give legal advice. No way, not on this, not on a webinar like this. But should you give the disclosure required by North Carolina? I think you gotta talk to your attorney. Caution is the word of the day. They're your licensing regulator. Look at what they say. Look at their press releases. Look at what they're telling the public. Even though the statute may say something different, because I think that a lot of this confusion, a lot of these amorphous and hard to figure out restrictions and guidance can spell trouble later on.
Okay. If this were an episode of Sesame Street, I can come on and say we brought to you by the words caution in Constitution.
Yes.
Would that work?
That's good. Very good.
All right, excellent. Well, listen, yes. Don, Stephanie, Don, Michael, Manny, thank you so much. This was awesome. I'm sure we could continue talking, and I'm sure we'll be back talking about this sooner rather than later, because I know the state, you know, we're going to see more states doing this. So I look forward to having you back soon. Thank you very much. This was awesome. Thanks to everybody who asked questions and signed up and stuck around. Stay tuned for more news in the very near future, and I hope everybody stays safe. Thank you.
Stay healthy. Social distancing.
Thank you.
Bye.